Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Happy Cinco de Mayo, which ended France's last attempt at empire in the Western Hemisphere. Unfortunately, a few years later, it established one in Southeast Asia. And happy birthday to Loyola Merriman, who is platinum today. If she had been a boy, she would have been named Ignatius, or Iggy, by her father, who was a member of the Jesuit laity and promised that his first child would be named after the Jesuit founder. Larry Zeke, KMUN Archivist Supremo, has sent me a magnificent cornucopia of KMUN recordings he has made over the past 33 years and converted to CDs. Among them is a wonderful program Howard Bruner made of a journey to Southern Oregon, walking through desert and mountains, recording the sounds of birds and animals in March 1990. His vocal descriptions of the landscape and encounters with wildlife and his whispered attempts to capture their voices splendidly illuminated the versatility that radio can attain. Perhaps some of you remember Howard and that he and his wife Deanne and children once lived in Astoria. Howard was always engaged in wilderness matters, fixing up injured animals and oil-soaked birds. He was licensed by the state of Oregon to rehabilitate injured or diseased wildlife, lobbying for environmental policies within the city and the state, and trekking through mountains, forests, and deserts. And he's probably still doing all that from Eugene, where he and his family moved in the early 1990s, or wherever he might now be. He is also a good and prolific writer. So I rummaged through back issues of my old newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, and dug up a few of Howard's stories to read on today's program. I'll start with Astoria's Urban Forest by Howard Bruner. This was written in 1988. The Alaskan hills seemed remote and visionary as the ferry rumbled north in July 1974. A verdant forest rolled back into fjords and valleys toward unguessable wilderness. My sister and I were on the last leg of a two-month bicycle trip that had taken us up the backbone of the Rocky Mountains, from Utah to Prince Rupert, British Columbia, and thence upon the sea to the lower lip of the southeast Alaskan panhandle. A quest into the fabled land, searching for beasts and the wilds they thrive in. The mood amongst fellow travelers was jubilant, everyone anticipating an irreversible jump into new adventures. The captain announced our arrival at Ketchikan, first stop in Alaska. The excited hum of talk faltered and died as we rounded a peninsula and got our first look at the city. Ketchikan is built on a hill very similar to Astoria. But the hillside above and behind the town was very different from Astoria's forested heights. Everyone stood in shock, looking at the moonscape clear-cut that came right down to the edge of the city. A long moment of doubt passed through me as I considered having to spend time in a city of people who had done this to their home. My sister and I had seen many a clear-cut on the journey north, but never one so indecently close to daily human contact. We didn't stay long in that town, for indeed the frontier mentality was greased with greed and honed with public apathy and alcohol. Recently, Astoria came uncomfortably close to joining Ketchikan as a town with no aesthetic or biologic sensibilities. The urban forest, which caps our hills with an emerald crown, was threatened by a sizable clear-cut. A big infusion of one-time cash had the city government actually laying plans to violate the integrity of our unique skyline. In the flurry of effort to educate the public as to the ultimate result of logging an acknowledged slide area, it came to light that these groves included an old-growth Sitka spruce and western hemlock remnant, a now rare example of the major plant community originally covering these coastal mountains. Somehow, close to miraculously, This swale of ancientness survived at least two thorough cuttings of the hillsides, back when Astoria vied with Ketchikan for title of city where money is boss. This astounding discovery was met with denial and apathy by members of the local timber industry. The city's forest consultant, who I assume came up with the original ill-conceived proposal to log, had actually cruised the tract and professed ignorance of the existence of any old growth. To top it off, one gypo got up at the public meeting called to assess public sentiment and claimed that all clear cuts were beautiful. Dismay grew towards anger as it became clear that this is one industry in need of some vigorous slaps of reality. One slap to awaken these individuals and agencies to the mandate of multiple use. Another slap to make said entities cognizant of harvesting alternatives, less reliance on devastating clear cutting, which would result in less habitat destruction and less impact on critical adjacent resources like water and slopes. The result would optimistically supplant the timber industry as the guiding voice in our public agencies, state and federal, that administer the public lands. Supplant the voice of an industry that is like a fat, spoiled child, as evidenced by the arrogance and ignorance of those representative loggers at public meetings. These slaps might help put the industry back in its proper role as a few profiteers capitalizing on a public resource, and might help release the death grip that these individuals and corporations have on our natural heritage. As human members of the life zone of Earth, we are all stewards of the land, plants, animals, air, and water. To have so few overwhelmingly impact the health of one of the most extensive and productive forests on Earth has got to change. If we, as the public, the ultimate consumers of the wood products these forests supply, demand a new set of management priorities, these loggers had better heed the call. As our knowledge of the natural systems that fuel the biodiversity of this planet grows and deepens, our sight begins to clear, and we can just make out the precarious position that we, as reapers and disruptors, find ourselves in. A position that shows it is time to reevaluate our relationship with the Earth and all other forms of life sharing it with us. The Astoria situation is indicative of the problem everywhere else in the Northwest. How will we resolve the seemingly conflicting needs of an intact, viable ecosystem and the ravaged debauchery that is left when harvesting wood? In the past few years, the conviction has sprouted, grown, and flowered in me. A knowledge that one of the major criteria for our success as the pinnacle species on this earth is acceptance of our role as the ultimate stewards of the universe. As we degrade or enhance other life forms' existence, so goes our own. Allowing the non-manipulated evolution of communities like our old-growth coniferous woods is more than ensuring biodiversity and resilience. It is the symbiotic growth of human and non-human towards acceptance. Acceptance of the universal scheme of things and our place in it is a realization that will lead to enlightenment. And that was in the North Coast Times-Eagle, July 1988. And a second article by Howard Bruner, Cedar Grove. Having concealed the canoe and recheck the map, we are now hurrying up a logging road, racing clouds that grow blacker as they drop to the treetops. It's bound to be a wet afternoon, but we push through the wind, driven as by a bright promise. We hope to locate the last grove of age-purified trees on Long Island, Washington, to walk among trees that have nurtured us from prehistoric times, to experience an original forest. Gusts splatter us with thick, cold raindrops and try to force us away. Slugs and mushrooms are everywhere, bright, warm touches on the cold, emerald palette of the coast. We walk down lanes of recent debauched management through aisles of 20-foot-high conifer in a death struggle with red alder. Land that has been cut, planted, and cut again. I am familiar with this mangled forest, for in 8 years of traipsing this coast, I have invariably found myself in second, third, or no growth, bald-ass clear cuts. We approach from an old road, turned elk trail, and as we fight heavy brush, I am aware of my anticipation growing as heavy as the overcast. The path turns sour, and we flounder for new direction, only for a moment. Then the presence on the horizon quiets us, and we both turn as one, as if beckoned by an unheard call. Looking through head-high Christmas-colored salal, we see the perimeter sentinels, and for a long time, just gape. They stand like great elephant legs, massive silver-gray columns rising up and tickling the black-bellied clouds. Their tops are gone, torn off by hideously powerful tempests, made vulnerable by the modern forestry method of cutting to the line, regardless of the structural needs and habitat necessities of forest life. As we pass the outer gates, the air calms, the howling winds stop at the door, and we are allowed to go on. I suspect that the kindred powers of earth and sky have reached stalemate. We move amongst these titans as ants would travel through grass. The air is dense with oxygen, almost visible as a thick green presence. We are enveloped by the growth. I feel a shift of awareness, a subtle arousal of new perceptions. It is a phenomenon I have felt before, always brought on by a certain wildness, a fine riotous assemblage of the life forms on this earth. It is the stilling of the inner chatter that we humans entertain ourselves with incessantly. It is the miraculously simple metamorphosis from distractions to clarity. It is the lost art of being here now. I let go and absorbed by the forest. I am overwhelmed by a feeling of well-being, an idiotic grin threatening to split my face in half. I have arrived. I am home. The rain is left behind with the wind. Only single drops filtered and fattened through the distant canopy make it to the ground. To join the waterways interlaced everywhere, arteries of diamond clear water. Fallen bodies of trees, venerable in life and now ancient in death, form bubbling grottos and subterranean rills lined with elfin ferns interspersed with bright fungi. Deeper into the grove, the young trees are thriving, protected by a structural integrity non-existent around the perimeter clear cuts. Generations are in evidence, from the fallen ancestors to the rambunctious saplings pushing up through the green twilight of the mature monarchs. Sound has become transformed, muted. If one were belligerent enough to rouse up a primal scream, I have no doubt that animals within sight would not hear it. An acoustic void, carpeted with thirsty sponge moss, thick and soft and as green as the eyes of a sand shark. The continuing existence of this grove was not until very recently the result of a concerned stewardship. On the contrary, it is here because cedar wasn't worth cutting when the first loggers came to let in the light. It has survived since then like most other old growth, by a series of events, fortuitous and coincidental. Now this grove has been acquired and placed under protection from further cutting, but the remaining majority of these last stands are being eyed by those with insatiable appetites and sharpened saws. These timber gluttons have placed the death mark on most of the remaining tall trees in the northwest. They reason that the trees will always grow again and in an orderly, predictable way, so why not finish the job? Every resource of this planet is here for our exclusive use, right? This ideology has guided humanity's behavior since the innocent past, when our numbers didn't threaten to overwhelm every other life form's niche on this planet. Indeed, we have lorded over this biosphere like depraved royalty, and few have stopped to look behind and study the carnage. Other forms of life sharing our planet must be accorded their evolutionary rights. In the high court of existence, we are three-time losers with a record of transgressions that have resulted in the absolute elimination of species that had been on this planet far longer than us. Now these isolated remnants of the sea of green are to be eradicated before we even understand all the dynamics of the myriads of species dependent upon them, so vital yet so vulnerable. As we reluctantly walk back out to meet the rain, I turn and look back into the velvet deeps, moved to quiet exaltation with the power there. I ponder the fate of these vibrant communities, to be turned into yet more moonscape clearcuts, or to be left alone to face the evolutionary mandate and build upon millions of years of refinement. This is a generation of hard choices that will be of much importance to the future. We will be either vilified as fools who have allowed the last paradisical portions of our planet to disappear, or be celebrated as far-seeing visionaries who permitted the future its share of pure earth. I come as a pilgrim seeking contact with the innate power of life, and I treasure this grove more than all our machined brilliance. Like those before me and those after, the need for an original view of pre-industrial earth is paramount to our clear perception of this reality. I have walked where God's great dream lies unblemished, and I have felt the wind of the past blow down my neck. It is chill, and it is pure, and it demands justice. And that was Cedar Grove, and was in the North Coast Times Eagle, February 1988. And a third by Howard Bruner, Big Noise. I walk alone on paths traveled before, and that will be traveled again. My companion fairly dances with anticipation, taking me to experience a jewel in the emerald green coast mountains. Together we climb old logging grades, and together we tire and rest. But I am as separate and isolated from him as he from me, as all beings walking this earth, forming individual consensus and singular perceptions, joined only by ghosts walking, silent, heads bowed, heeding the summons that brought us forth. The roadside trees are mostly third growth, about 20 feet high, hemlock, firs, spruce, and alder, the customary flora of the rain belt. Bright green salal intermixes with frost-browned ferns, the color of milked down coffee. We reach our destination by early afternoon, surrounded by rain-blackened cedar stumps cast across a meadow of warm brown grass, sprinkled throughout a few standing remnants, broken-topped and as black as the stumps. Low squalls pass over, exchanging sunlight for earthlight, a nut brown glow from the grass. The sky breaks into patches of washed blue, and sunlight fills the meadow with sparklings. This lake turned bog, turned cedar grove, turned meadow, changed from forces as varied as the life forms thriving here now, seemingly filled to the brim with elk, deer, and rodents, everywhere and nowhere, never seen but felt and acknowledged through impacts on every side. The vegetation tells a troubled story of the forces acting upon it. Some low bushes turn out to be 50-year-old hemlock, meticulously pruned into elk bonsai, trimmed and shaped by 500-pound sculptors. These butterball hemlocks had it easy compared with the conifers that have bear-killed tops and living tissue only as high as a stretching black bear. A mild breeze follows us into the alder grove, accompanying the stream that cuts the meadow in half. Inside, all is matted with inches of moss, every shape softened green. Trails meander from one forage to the next. Huckleberries and willows stand waist high until the willow gains height by water's edge. Beaver have been here for millennia, being as responsible for the present conditions here as that of any other force. Now gone. Turned into a tune-up on some punk's motorcycle or a down payment on a new rifle, transposed from a viable member of the realm to a bauble serving the whim of our ignorance. Stewardship and wisdom. Very few examples of these qualities are apparent in our past relationship with our home. For in these hills, the natural front is totally manipulated, a mockery of what was the culmination of eons of trial and error evolution. virgin timber is so rare that in all my wanderings I have yet to find that silence that comes with a venerable grove of monarchs. The regime that administers these lands is a frightening mixture of fools and power brokers, neither having the right to slash and poison the forest into subservience. We have reached the heart, the center and focus. The stream is diamond bright, spots of cress greening the eddies. Strange forms of moss parasitize the fallen alders half submerged, a long moment soaking in, aware that all creatures look to the water as the greatest gift in this bounteous realm. The evening is drawing up and the sky lays on the ridges surrounding our valley. The call is to leave, to get out and re-insulate us against the coming dark and cold, but we stay and watch the earth glow light the trees and water. And as we finally turn away, we stumble upon one of those giant fir logs that lie under the second growth canopy, deep in the ground, rot having claimed most of it, still impressive enough to make us want to play on it. These trees were cut and left because the grain was not as straight as the flight of an arrow. Their growth is in tight circle, like a barber's pole. This log is not long for this world, headed back to soil, the entire heart gone, but enough remaining to form a big tube, a tube of toasty air, the result of the sun's heat, trapped yet a last time in this paragon of solar collectors. I walk alone, headed back, my companion as silent as the woods. No color remains, the forest changed to gray-black splotches on either side of the path. Stars have the last word in sky dominance. The inevitable sadness is growing as we near the return to compromised living, the wild subdued and perverted. I have walked these hills for years and I will walk longer still, for I have only to leave the road and turn the bend and the way brightens, to shed the raiment of complex life, to delve into layers of self not accessible without returning to primitive rapport. To find the silence that accompanies the raging diversity of the wild, that stilling of the internal dialogue, that extraordinary feat of being here now. These hills are only superficially damaged, their power being older and greater than the reckless new dominance of us. Torn and bleeding, this land rebounds, and where left alone, riotous life reestablishes and habitats are reborn. I walk alone, and yet the company of those who have walked before, in great humility and awe. And perhaps these ghosts will be joined by those yet to come, a race of giants that will know there is nothing more sacred than a walk in the woods. And that was Big Noise. And it was in the North Coast Times Eagle, May 1986. And a final story by Howard, Notes from a Catastrophe, with a quote by Rachel Wynn. All I could think of when I saw the hundreds of birds covered with oil was, bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. They started showing up right after Christmas, victims of a battle rumored to be safely distant and controlled. Not so, spoke the bewildered eyes of the injured, innocent eyes filled with pain, eyes that, like as not, dulled as the spark of life escaped and one was left with the sodden body of a creature destroyed by its encounter with the black, deadly goo we humans treasure. Oil spill, the description of an event so expensive to the ocean resource that it should be named Major Life Zone Extermination. That some goddamn cowboys can be ultimately in a position of power over so many of us, and with just a few stupid moves create the kind of havoc that these animals have experienced. This cries for an intelligent reaction, like safeguards, training, more emphasis on prevention, less timetable greed, and more commitment to responsibility if all of the above fail and we experience major life zone extermination. The system is sick and retching up. Birds stagger onto beaches in the last effort at survival. If the dogs don't get them, the blowing sand will. These little feathered barometers of the health of the ocean are the first wave, an antagonized and tortured company of stalwarts reacting to the destruction of their niche with uncomprehending perseverance. They battle mightily for survival, flying sightless in my arms in spasms and poisoned seizures, heads uncontrollably bobbing as they thrash away the last shreds of vital energy and are gone. Valhalla for those we have destroyed, a bird heaven where stupidity and greed are not the guiding motivations of the dominant life form. One acquaintance called and asked why I didn't do the birds a favor and just wring their necks. Maybe this jerk was right. Maybe any effort to cure and rehabilitate is just a postponement of the inevitable final destruction this planet is heading for. I cannot follow up this logic. I must continue to personally counteract the results of our industrialized species. The mail just came, and I found in it reasons to hope. For amongst the piles of bills and junk mail was a shiner, a gem of the human capabilities, the resounding affirmation that humans can evolve and inherit their world as a paradise. It is a matter of setting priorities. The proper reaction to an event like this is for the stewards and masters to repair and renew the damage. Every person dependent upon the oil that was lost must acknowledge his or her responsibility. All of us should be rehabilitators, as all of us should live by the precept that our ultimate function on this earth should be to make it better. The letter that makes it all worth doing is from the third grade class of Gearhart School, with money that the children earned to help feed the injured birds. And that was Notes from a Catastrophe by Howard Bruner, and was in the Times Eagle, January 1989. The oil spill Howard Bruner wrote about was from an oil barge off Grays Harbor, Washington, on December 22, 1988. More than 200,000 gallons of bunker oil spilled into the ocean. Hundreds of stricken birds soon washed up on Clatsop beaches. Howard and a number of local volunteers, including Rachel Wynn, worked to clean the birds and release them back into the wild. Howard was himself able to set almost 20 birds loose from his Astoria home. And the opposition against logging off the Astoria City Forest in 1988 was intense and vocal when Howard wrote about it that year. He helped start the Tree Musketeers, All for the Trees and the Trees for All. The city council capitulated and the forest remains. But now, with pressure for so-called affordable housing because of the real estate tsunami that has inundated Astoria and destituted many of its citizens, protection of the city forest might be waived for home construction, which is, of course, the fervent ambition of local gypo loggers and realtors, as well as developers, all of whom salivate for predator profits. If the forest is sacrificed for affordable housing, who will it be affordable for? This has been Michael McCusker.